The next bill for your
House Bill 127, introduced by the Management Council, an act relating to the general revision of laws, obsolete laws, general revisions. This bill was referred to committee number 12, which is rules and procedures, and they recommended it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Buchanan, Cohey, Gingrey, Goggles, Illaway, Jorgensen, Landon, Lubnow, Meyer, Philp, Simpson, excused, Korberg, Throne. Signed, Representative Simpson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Speaker Simpson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 127 do pass. There is a standing committee amendment, and I would like to explain the bill a little beforehand, Madam Chairman, before we get to the standing committee amendment, if you would allow that.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, House Bill 127, Obsolete Laws, General Revisions. This year, during Management Council discussions, this issue came up. It was suggested to us by our LSO attorneys that there were provisions in our statutes that were simply obsolete or incorrect after court rulings. And this is the first part of a multi-year process referred to as cleaning the attic. And these are not pure technical cleanup like the revisor's bill. And some of the items that were in here, if you don't like them, you can pull them out and we could refer them to the appropriate standing committee. And that standing committee could then review the issue. But the standing committees are not revising statutes as they have in the past. And we can catch things better now with the computer systems that we have. In the past, without the computers, the standing committees would do a full review of an act or articles in an act, and we're doing that more and more through technology. An example, term limits, still on the books, although it was found unconstitutional. So we can remove that from the books. If there was any doubt, the interim committee was recommended, such as judiciary and corporations. This bill is an exception to the single subject provisions of the Constitution for those strict constructionists out there, because there is an exception to that for general revisions to statutes. So relax. And there's a handout. It HB 127 LQ HD 28 there. This shows you, it walks you through it a little bit, and I'd like to take a little more time than on this one than I did on the revisor's bill, unless there's a unanimous vote that I do not. But I'll go ahead. Section 101, you'll see on page 1 of the bill, line 10, section 1, provisions affected by court decisions. Line 11, provisions held to be unconstitutional. Well, all of Wyoming Statute 11114 was found to be unconstitutional. The only thing that wasn't was the last sentence of that section. So we're leaving that in. And then Section 102 repeals 114.128. Then Section 1B. Page 1, line 31 of the bill. Provisions affected by court decisions other than holdings based on constitutional grounds. And that goes into appraiser's fees. It clarifies what that statute actually means, that it's a qualified appraiser shall receive a reasonable fee. Page 2, line 13, section 2, provisions which are obsolete due to earlier legislative action and subsequent implementation. Justice of the Peace references, those are removed. Page 3, line 18, provisions which are obsolete due to earlier legislative action and subsequent implementation. That simply says that the fines collected go to the state treasurer and are provided and credit as provided. Page 3, line 43, provisions which are obsolete because they're fully executed. They've been fully performed. And that goes page 4 over to page 5. Page 5, line 19, we're into archaic references. Because we no longer refer to an ex officio recorder of deeds, we refer to that person as the county clerk. So, thankfully, that applies to pages 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. Now, we're at page 18, line 29, provisions which are obsolete because they are archaic references, and those are just repealing those provisions. Section 3, incorrect citations or failure to update cross-references, and that goes over to page 19 and 20. Page 20 has got some section, other than section 100s in there, there's section 501. And this relates to an earlier provision in the bill, but section 501 that says all properties and duties of the Wyoming Centennial Commission are transferred to the State Board of Land Commissioners. And that's because we're repealing this provision about the Wyoming Centennial Acre. When the centennial happened, you could buy a centennial acre. Well, because those ownership interests are still out there, we still need some entity for people to communicate with or hold the, I'm not sure if it's title or whatever it is with the Centennial Acre, but that's what Section 501 does. And Madam Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 127 that simply catches another one of these that was discovered after the bill was numbered and jacketed. And this goes into section 208 on page 18. This standing amendment simply memorializes what actually occurs, that the state treasurer establish accounts for the state government units, and then the state treasurer may prescribe the monetary limit. The Department of A&I does not do those things, and the treasurer does not do those things with the concurrence of the Department of A&I. So I would call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 and answer any questions anyone may have on that or the bill.
Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment 1 to House Bill 127 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Okay. Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman or Speaker Simpson's motion when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, we do so with the recommendation that Bill number 127 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 127 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 130. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 130, introduced by Representative Ellaway, an act relating to state parks and cultural resources, guarding the matching account. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended that it do pass Ayes, Bonner, Brown, Childers, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, Millen, Shepperson, Thompson. Signed, Representative Childers, Chairman. The bill was further referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phelps, Stewart. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Childers?
Madam Chairman, I move when Committee of Whole rises report it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 130 do pass. And there are no standing committee amendments, and I will turn the bill over to the good representative from District 42 to cover the bill.
Chairman Ellaway.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I wanted to make sure that
when the good speaker talked about the centennial acre that, matter of fact, I don't know how many people actually own centennial acre, but I do have a deed that says I own a piece of that. That's a long time ago. Anyway, state parks matching account. An interesting little piece of legislation, and the reason why. June of last year, several of us were invited to a June 9th, 2008, several of us were invited to a get-together in regards to Kurt Gowdy State Park. And a gentleman was from a large sporting goods store, was offering to give to the state parks $100,000 because he liked and was a very good friend of Kurt Gowdy. Additionally, this gentleman pledged, and I have the his signed letter that says that if we would pass some type of legislation that would allow a match at Kurt Gowdy State Park, he would pledge in his letter $900,000 over 4 years. Well, I thought that was pretty good. That's quite something to be able to pick up that much money. But I wanted to do it for all of the state parks. And the historical sites and cultural resources, because matching funds have been really a great way of building some of our infrastructure, like over at the University of Wyoming, and we've done it with some other items. So this bill comes to you that says that we've created an account. The earnings from the account shall be retained. We've created the State Parks and Cultural Resources matching account, whereas the department may accept and shall deposit in the matching account any gift, contribution, donation, or grant for the benefit of state parks, historical sites, or cultural resources. The matching account shall consist of all donations received into the account, any matching funds transferred pursuant to this subsection, and any earnings from monies in the account. A donor to the matching account may specify a particular state park, historical site, or cultural resource for the application of the donation. If the department accepts a donation for a specific state park, historical site, or cultural resource, the department shall ensure that those funds and any matching funds received under subsection B of this section are expended in accordance. And what we have done, there is a committee of the whole amendment that fits in after donor on line 5 that says, let me read a couple lines. It says that of this section are expended in accordance with the intent of the donor and in concert with the goals of the department relative to the 2007 operations plan of the department as periodically updated. And the reason we did this, we were in appropriations, joint appropriations, and this looked like what the department has a plan. Let me get it. This is known as the Operation Plan, Wyoming Division of State Parks, Historic Sites and Trails, May of 2007. It is periodically updated. It shows what is going on at state parks. We did receive a list of what can be donated, how it can be donated to state parks. And, of course, there are many state parks, there are many historic sites, there are cultural resource programs, and we thought that the best way to do this was to insert the Committee of the Whole amendment that says, in concert with the goals of the department relative to the 2007 operations plan. So I'd call for a question on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 130.
All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 130, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment has been adopted.
What can happen with this, and we started out, and Madam Chairman of the Appropriations Committee may want to say something, and I hope she does, that anybody can give to a particular state park, historical site, cultural resource, and hopefully have it matched, and we anticipated one-for-one match, and it would be first come, first serve. We started out, actually I started out with $5 million earlier this year, and because of the way the economy went, dropped it to $1 million, and that would cover the $225,000 a year that this president of this large sporting goods store has pledged. But there would still be a little bit of wiggle room in there if somebody wanted to give some money. And we already know that Fort Bridger out in southwestern Wyoming was the recipient of a grant of, it was from a particular trust, and the Fort Bridger Historical Site was given a gift of $50,000. So we know that there are people out there that feel very strongly about their particular state park, cultural resources, or historical site. And we think this is a great way to help the state parks grow. They're always short of money. They continue to come back to us for additional funds. And this was a way that we thought we could help them out. So, Madam Chair of the Appropriations Committee, do you want to say anything?
Chairman Childers, would you like to add to the discussion?
Well, Madam Chair, I'd planned on it, but I was waiting on the better-looking person to step up if she wanted to. And I might have to boost her a little bit.
Thank you, Chairman Berger. I was waiting for the good chairman from Travel and Rec to speak before I got up and barged in on his time. And thank you to the good chairman from Corporations. This bill I stand on I spent several years being a commissioner for the State Parks and Cultural Resources, and one of the things that I found really incredible about our 16 parks and historic sites is how little money they have to make such fabulous destinations for the citizens of Wyoming and our neighboring states. And when this came through appropriations, I felt that it was a real opportunity for the people of Wyoming to enhance our state parks. So I stand on and for the bill and appreciate your support.
Are we ready for the question? Chairman Childers.
You're not on this one. He's not on.
Well, Madam okay. Chair, I thought he wanted to talk. Ladies and gentlemen, as the House Chair of the Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, I thoroughly agree with what both the two chairs said about the state parks. And I also would say that we're talking about doing this for cultural resources, too, and what we have learned over the last few years of what is happening to some of our historical and cultural resources site, there's a pretty good indication there's a fair amount of money that's going to be needed to take care of those, to basically keeping them from falling apart. And I thoroughly understand with the economy the way it is today that we would need help doing that. And I think this establishment of this account takes care of that, and I commend the chairman of corporations for bringing the bill, and the state parks director for working with him to prepare it. So I stand in support and turn it back over to him if he won't say anything.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Childers' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 130 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 130 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 54. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 54, introduced by the Labor Committee, an act relating to Wyoming Workers' Compensation Act. This bill was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Goggles, Hallinan, Harvey, Landon, Millen, Shepperson. Signed, Representative Landon. It was further referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which we recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phelps, Stewart. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Lander? Landon.
Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 54 do pass. Further, I move the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Madam Chairman, let me just start out kind of share a little history with the body on workers' compensation. It was 109 years ago, a little over in January, that Governor Joseph Carey urged the legislature to pass a Workers' Compensation Act. That was 1913. And there were important reasons to do this. One of which was to furnish prompt and reasonable compensation to injured employees. In response to that urging from the governor, the legislature put before the voters an amendment to Article 10, Section 4 of our Constitution, which prohibits laws limiting damages for personal injury cases. It's my understanding that that particular clause in our Constitution was put in there because one of the big employers in the early days when the Constitution was written was the railroads, and there were a lot of people got injured on the railroads, and they did not want to make the railroad exempt from recovery from personal injury by the workers. So a bill authorized that the legislature could create a workers' compensation law which would provide for the maintenance of funds out of which compensation would be paid to injured workers in lieu of the common law rights of action. And that amendment to the Constitution was passed by the voters. In 1915, newly elected John B. Kendrick, a little aside, from Sheridan County, the governor at that time, urged the legislature use due care in exercising these functions contemplated to render a just compensation to the injured and in case of death to those dependent on him, but at the same time to avoid so far as possible the working of hardship upon excessive hardship upon the industry that pays the taxes. So that's kind of the trade-off and the balance that the workers' compensation is asked to walk that line, where the workers' compensation law concept is in the form of a trade-off in which employees, in exchange for giving up their common law rights of recovery against their employers for work-related injuries, receive certain benefits regardless of the fault. And employers, in exchange for funding the workers' compensation system, receive immunity from the lawsuits brought on behalf of injured workers. Just as an aside, only about 25% of the injured workers back in those days even brought lawsuits against their employers. So there were many, many people that went without any recovery from injuries. The Workers' Compensation Act has achieved in large measure what it was intended to do. So let me lead you through the bill, and I'll just go through the changes that are proposed, and then I'll stand for questions. I'll also show in my explanation where the standing committee amendments come in. On page 3, you can see some new language, and that has to do with sole proprietors and partners being brought in under the Workers' Compensation Act, and that will be covered on pages 4 and 5. On page 4, you can see some new language starting on line 3, and this has to do with recoveries. The Workers' Compensation Division, if a recovery is made from a third party, be that an insurance company or an employer or a subcontractor or something, the state can go back and ask for recovery of those funds that have been spent on workers' compensation up to a third of those recovery of that amount. But it was thought that since the employee was the one who had brought the action, that the state should also not leave the employee solely responsible for the attorney's fees, and so the state is going to pay their pro rata share of the attorney's fees depending on how much they recover from that action. That will leave more dollars in the employer's pocket. The next part that you see on little K under 2714108 brings in partnerships and sole proprietorships as being covered also under workers' compensation. One of the first amendments that you'll see on standing committee amendment number 1 is on line 11 on page 4, and it further defines the partnership and proprietorship as being those who employ two or more employees. And the reason for that is this is to kind of keep that balance to where the employees will get compensation or be taken care of for their injuries, and employers not sued. But if it was felt that that trade-off didn't exist in a sole proprietorship or a partnership where the only the owner himself might be insured, that he wasn't going to sue himself, and so that trade-off no longer existed unless he had employees. Then further on, once again covers. Ensures that a partnership or sole proprietorship or a corporation that chooses to elect coverage for their officers also elect coverage for all their employees. We deleted language on line 9 and 10 on page 5 that you see in the standing committee amendment that just read following the initial eight calendar quarters of coverage. That didn't seem to be significant when a person was wanting to terminate coverage. And finally, we also added an amendment on lines 14, and this was where if a corporation, partnership, or sole proprietor were going to terminate the coverage that they could not terminate the coverage just for their employees, but they had to. They could terminate coverage for the officers themselves, but if they wanted to terminate, they could either continue to cover the employees or else all of them, officers and partners, would be included if they chose to terminate coverage for employees. You can see on the bottom of line 5, this starts a portion of the statutes that that deals with premium credits. When the system becomes overfunded, is for whatever reason, whether employees are paying too much, whether the safety records are going up, whether there's not enough, whether thank goodness there hasn't been the amount of injuries to require the resources, and there's extra money, is in the old system, is you had to reimburse all of the employees equally. This has changed in this section, and if this, and you can see the new language that's added on page 6, line 12, that if the actuary who's retained by the division says that the amount of money is fully reserved, then a premium credit can be granted. When the division determines that premium credit, then they will allow a credit back to employers. And you can see on little 3 down there is the way that it read before is you had to give it to all employers who had paid into the system, even those who just recently come into the system who may not have paid premiums during the whole year. This restricts it. This premium credit, if it's granted, shall only go to those employers who have paid premiums during the preceding year. They're the ones who would be owed some credit. And also, it's those who are the good actors that have their accounts current and all the amounts that they owe and everything current. So we wanted to put this in to reward those who really make the system work. Going over to page 7, this gets into the awards section of the Workers' Compensation Act. And we have adjusted quite a few awards in the Act. This is the first one that you'll see. This is an adjustment of awards for children of employees who are killed on the job. And what we looked at was, how much are they getting from Social Security? How much are they getting from the state? And how does this compare to the amounts that that the state figures for a custodial parent that they should be paying for child support? And we increase the amount on that from 150 up to 250 as being the state share. And by doing that, that actually increases the amount of benefits to a child to above what they would be paid for child support in a similar fashion. We also increase the age that children would qualify to continue getting this from 18 up to 21. And then we also increase the time if the child was physically or mentally incapacitated until for the life of that child, and that is unless they're become part of the care that the state provides under Medicaid, and then that is no longer paid. And you can see that if a child is enrolled in an educational institution, the age goes from 21 to 25. Finally, on that page, as part of the Committee of the Whole amendment at the bottom, to make this uniform with another COLA provision that we have in the bill that we'll see later on, is we add language at the end that not only is this amount adjusted for inflation using the Consumer Price Index or its successor, but it will be adjusted at that amount or 3%, whichever is less. On page 8, we are looking at awards awarded for permanent partial impairment. The time that the benefits start, you can see it used to be when they, or the amount that is figured for the benefit, it used to be the amount that was figured when the injury occurred. That was changed to when the benefits were first paid. Sometimes there's a delay in that, and sometimes there's some controversy in that. We also wanted to increase the amount that that person would receive during that time, and so we put a base of 30% of the statewide average monthly wage, or two-thirds of the injured worker's annual actual monthly earnings at the time of the injury, whichever is greater. However, we found that we had inadvertently, for a very low wage earner, increased that amount to where it was actually more beneficial to stay on permanent partial impairment than to go back to work. So we added a line that you see on the Standing Committee Amendment on line 29, where on line 16, the amount shall not exceed the lesser of 100% of the injured worker's actual monthly earnings at the time of the injury. So if it's a low-wage earner, they can earn essentially what they were earning previously while they're recovering from this permanent partial, or in determining the amount of their permanent partial impairment award.
Madam Chairman.
Mr. Speaker.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Page 8, line 13. The 30% of the statewide average monthly wage, or two-thirds of the injured employee's actual monthly earnings, whichever is greater. How did you arrive at 30% of the statewide average monthly wage?
Chairman Landon.
Madam Chairman, we arrived at that as being kind of a base amount that that you wouldn't want some people to go below, because it was basically just kind of a survival amount of compensation. Where we ran into trouble is if the person were a part-time employee and working for even lesser wages, then we added the new language in there. But that was an effort to put some realistic survival amount of money in there for that award.
Madam Chairman, I have one more question. On page 8, line 16 through 19, this is the whichever is greater, but not to exceed the statewide monthly average for the 12-month period immediately preceding the quarterly period in which the injury occurred. The words injury occurred on line 19 don't seem to be consistent with the change made on page 8, line 10, about when benefits were first paid. Any comment on that?
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chairman, my first comment is that that I have been referring to the permanent partial impairment award, when in fact this award, as you can see on line 11, has to do with the temporary total disability. So this is the case where the worker is expected to be coming back to work, and the question had to do with the consistency between the two. We struggled with that and what our intent was, and I had to read it several times, and I'd have to do it again probably several times. But what our intent was that we did not want to exceed 100% of the injured worker's actual monthly earnings at the time of injury. So that's why that was put into there, even though previous amounts had set a floor. Madam Chairman, the other thing that I should reference for the body's information is the fiscal note, so that you can see how much these various initiatives are adding to the expenses or adding to the income of the workers' compensation account. The one that we have just talked about added to the expenses of the workers' compensation account and would provide workers who are on temporary total disability, all of the workers in the state who happen to find themselves in that unfortunate condition, that would cost $248,000. You can see that the increase in children's benefits that we talked about earlier, that is going to add about $1 million, $974,000. And while I'm reviewing this, adding the partnerships and sole proprietors, that actually, you can see it has an estimated premiums that are paid, as well as an estimated expense, and that is expected to net positive from the Department of Employment's estimations. Madam Chairman, forging on ahead on page 9, on little Romanette 4, this has to do with death. We increased the awards in this to 75% of the employee's actual monthly earnings at the time of injury, or as you can see in the preceding paragraph, that the award would be adjusted to not less than 80%, whichever is greater. In no event shall the award exceed 2 times the statewide average monthly wage. And for your information right now, 2 times the statewide, or the average monthly wage right now, I believe, is $3,384. That had a fiscal impact of $76,000. Most of these death benefit impacts were not too great because, fortunately, that is not a frequent occurrence. The next award, starting with little 5 on the permanent partial disabilities, there is 184 individuals in the state of Wyoming who presently have permanent partial disabilities, and there's approximately 9 a year that unfortunately are find themselves in this condition. And on page 10, you will see that we added at the bottom of page 9 and on page 10, we added an inflation adjustment to those individuals. And once again, it was the national index or 3%, whichever is less. We heard from individuals who had been awarded the permanent total disabilities, and one example was a man who was collecting $900 and some, close to $1,000. He'd been collecting that since mid-1995, and it never had changed. This was actually one of the more expensive items on the workers' compensation account. This was for $3.5 million, but we felt that this was justifiable. The next adjustment we made was to the surviving spouse and how long they would receive monthly payments, and that's also on page 10, line 12, and you can see we went from 54 to 100 months. And you will see on several of these an extension of the time that payments are allowed. And what we found was In the early 90s, the workers' compensation system was going broke, and there wasn't enough money. The monies coming in from premiums were barely paying for the injuries. There wasn't an amount built up that was actuarially covered the injuries that had occurred. And so a number of the benefits for workers were cut back. So I view this something as a pendulum. It's swinging back towards where it was. It's not going clear over to the other side. It's just kind of coming back to what we think is a more rational amount and something that people can survive on. This particular benefit would add $1.5 million to the expenses. The next changes you see at the bottom of page 10
Excuse
and
me.
On page 11.
Chairman Landon, I'd like to call on Chairman Illoway, please.
I just have a question on the surviving spouse. If that spouse should happen to marry later on, year, 2 years after the death, does that award continue or does it cease?
Chairman Landon.
Madam Chairman, that award ceases if the surviving spouse gets married or if the surviving spouse dies. And that was something we talked about a little bit, but we didn't make any adjustments to. The unfortunate thing that does is that's actually an incentive not to get married again. And that might be something that those who are interested in making reforms to this, maybe that should be adjusted down to a percentage or something of what they were previously getting if they were getting married or something. We didn't spend the time to try to come up with a judicious answer for that. Madam Chairman, back on the bottom of page 10 and 11, previously it talked about surviving parents receiving substantially all of their financial support from the employee at the time and what kind of award they would get if that was happening. Substantially all wasn't defined, so we defined that at least half. And then we changed the amounts that they would receive to more nearly match the amounts that were paid to a surviving spouse, but for a lesser amount of time. You can see on page 11, line 7, it's for 60 months instead of 100 months as for the spouse. So we tried to get there was a lot of different complicated things in there, and we just tried to make that simpler. The next change, let me see if there's, that had no significant fiscal impact. The next change had to do with medical care. There's written in the statutes that if you get your medical care within the state of Wyoming, you actually have enhanced benefits. Instead of paying at 66%, this is for temporary total disability payments, instead of paying you at 66% of your actual monthly wage, it'll pay at 70%, and the limit used to be 100% of the statewide average, and it's increased to 103% if you get your care within the state. Well, that works pretty well unless it's just irrational to get your care within the state. If you live around one of the border communities, say, and I'll just use Evanston as an example, and you need to see a neurologist, it's a lot more rational that you would go to Salt Lake City to see that neurologist than to go to Casper or Cheyenne. So we changed that and said that those, for purposes of this subsection, if those medical services are available within at a distance, if they were available and if the distance was not a difference of more than 100 miles, you see 50 miles in your bill on the Standing Committee Amendment, that was changed to 100 miles. If there's that much or less, or more, I should say, difference between getting in-state and out-of-state, you are not going to be penalized for going out-of-state for your care. Furthermore, we have another amendment on page 12 after line 21 where the injured worker is also not penalized if the employer has a contract agreement with an out-of-state health care provider. Some employers have an agreement for injured workers with an out-of-state provider, and that would also have penalized those workers by the employer contract of no fault of their own. So we put that exception in there. On page 13, this had to do, on starting on line 9, this had to do with permanent partial disabilities and permanent total disabilities. That's the 2714, 405, and 406. And this and this extended that benefit that a person was qualified for those two injuries, and it extended it through that time that the worker might be waiting to get a designation as a total disability, or that time when they were waiting for some kind of court action to work through. It maintained their payment through that time. It extends the time that the division will pay for those things, so the worker doesn't have to go without workers' comp for an extended time while things are being settled. That had a cost of around $350,000 per year. Next, we had to do the 2714405. Had to do with the permanent partial disability, and that you can see on lines 23, the award for that is first of all, you can see above there is licensed physicians use a medical association guide to determine the percent of impairment that a person has. And then that percent of impairment is multiplied by a number of months, and we increased that from 44 to 60. And that, as I recall, that was the exact number that it used to be back in 1995. The cost of that particular portion comes out to $2,886,000. So that will provide, that is expected to provide a greater benefit for employees that have the permanent partial disability. On the next page, on page 14, the amount of time that a person can avail themselves to vocational rehabilitation was increased from 4 to 5 years. On page 14 and 15, this has to do with the Attorney General bringing civil suit to recover benefits and money paid that was either paid by mistake or paid through fraud. Well, we didn't want to put any restrictions on recovery of any actions that were brought because of fraudulent activities. But there were some examples of payments that had been made by mistake, and so we did add the language at the top of page 15 that any of those civil actions that were resulting from a mistake that the division had made, they could only be limited to recovery for the mistaken payments within 12 months of the commencement of action. If it had happened for 4 years, that person had already spent that money 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago. And so this would just recover the money from the last year. The next part had to do with contested cases. On line 16, we had heard that from some employees that they felt that they were penalized because they did not meet certain times that were allocated, that something has to happen within this time. Some court action has to be happened at this time, something filed and so on. And they said it was the fault of their attorneys. And so we had wrote in a part here that if the division or hearing examiner determines that the worker's failure to meet a procedural deadline was through the fault of the worker's attorney, that the division could reconsider that determination and essentially start the clock again. It's also, and I should also make a note that the attorney will not be paid. We did at this part write in for a while that if the injured worker's failure to meet these deadlines were through the fault of the worker's attorney or through his incompetence, but that grew a lot of controversy, and we decided we needed to lump that with medical malpractice rules, so we deleted it. So incompetency isn't in there. That was supposed to be a joke, but there was not. I don't know how many people are listening. Finally, in Section 2, we added an appropriation of $200,000 from the workers' compensation account for two full-time positions with the Office of Administrative Hearings. It's our understanding that, and this will be to hire a full-time hearing examiner and a paralegal. The office does have room for those individuals, and we heard from a number of those who are testifying, as well as the division, that sometimes the periods of timing for hearings has taken a long time. The docket number has been going up over the years, and this is felt that this is just keeping up with the times, and they are really looking forward to hoping that this portion passes so that they can get this more under control, and I think that'll help with the complaints and make sure that injured workers and their problems are addressed more quickly. Madam Chairman, that pretty much covers the bill, and so I'll stand for any questions.
Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On page 4, and I'm sorry if I missed the explanation of this, page 4, lines 3 through 6, and this is the state's recovery of benefits paid if the employee were to sue a third party or a co-employee and get a judgment, a settlement, or something like that. Any recovery by the state shall be reduced pro rata for attorney's fees and costs in the same proportion as the employee is liable for fees and costs. What does it mean where it says in the same proportion as the employee is liable for fees and costs? Does that mean that the employee is liable to the attorney for the fees and costs?
Chairman Landon.
I believe what it means is this, that if there's a recovery made and a third of that recovery is a payment of the fee for the attorney, and a third of that recovery is kept by the employee, and a third of that recovery was recovered by the state for amounts previously paid, which I believe is the maximum that the state can recover. Is since the employee recovered a third, and since the division covered a third, then I think that since they each had half of that amount, then the employee would be expected to pay half of the attorney's fee, and the division would be expected to pay half of that attorney's fee. And the way that would work would be that of that recovery that was going back to the state, is that would be taken out of that recovery, and so that would be left with the employee.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had about, I guess I have 4 questions, and I'll just go through each one. My first question had to do with vocational rehab. You moved the time period from 4 to 5 years, which seemed to make sense since some people take a little bit longer to get through college.
So if their vocational rehab is to go to college and get a degree, perhaps that gives them a little bit more time. I was curious as to if there was discussion in the interim. There are two elements to vocational rehab: the time period, which I certainly agree with extending, that's fine, but also there's the other element of the amount of money we spend, and it's always limited to $30,000. I was just curious if there was discussion in the committee about moving that $30,000 out a little ways, especially with the cost of college and whatnot. That would be my first question. I guess I'll just give all these to you, and then you can answer them. My second question had to do with, just to make sure I was clear in my own head, the sole proprietorship issue, and I can't remember the case that came out last year, but there was that case that came out that said even though sole proprietors had been paying into the system, the Supreme Court said we don't cover sole proprietors. And if I recall the case correctly, they talked about what the purpose of the workers' comp system was, to the distinction between employee and employer, that this was a new system in 1913, so that the employee would not sue his employer, instead the workers' comp would come in. I'm just curious as to, the Supreme Court decision seemed to make some logical sense if you go back to what the original intent of workers' comp was. Is there a reason why we're allowing the owner of the company to protect himself from, I guess, suit from himself? And then if I understand it correctly, in the amendment, you've switched it from sole proprietor to sole proprietor that has two or more employees, which leads to my question, and this sort of goofy question, but I have a bunch of emails from taxi cab drivers in my community, and what their concern was that they're all sole proprietors. They want to be covered under workers' comp. And are they going to have to go hire two or more employees, or do they count as an employee so they only have to hire one more? So that was that question. And then if you could just explain, and I'm not opposed to it, I just didn't understand, this amendment that puts in on TTD that your rate is the same if you have a contractual agreement with an out-of-state health care provider. I just didn't understand that issue, if you could explain that. And then I guess my last question was, on fault of attorneys, we don't normally do that anywhere else in the statute I'm aware of, where we let you have a do-over because your attorney screwed up. I know, you know, there's a lot of statute of limitations that, you know, attorneys might miss, and their client is out of luck. I was just curious if there had been a discussion about ramifications beyond workers' comp. If we're allowing do-overs for faults of attorneys, is this leading toward allowing that in other areas too?
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We did discuss the rehabilitation and education opportunities as being extended from 4 to 5 years. And furthermore, we did discuss the total cost. And there's actually very few that will benefit from the 4 to 5 year extension. And the total cost, we were told, would still work out in there, that most of the training costs were well below that. And so they felt that upper limit was still quite sufficient. The discussion that you started on the sole proprietor brought a lot of discussion into the committee. And I think you've identified exactly what the issue is. The Supreme Court said there is no trade-off with a sole proprietor, nor is there any statutory language that allows a sole proprietor to be covered. So some had been paying into the system. After that court decision, I believe it was 60, and I may be wrong, it may have been 100 and some, sole proprietors were told that they no longer were in the system and they would not take premiums from them. Now, since that, why would a sole proprietor want to be covered? because the benefits that a person can get on workers' compensation can mainly be covered in three things. Life insurance, that's the death benefit. Health insurance, that would cover a great deal of the accidents and recovery from accidents. The third one, then, that employers would really benefit from is the disabilities insurance. And so a sole proprietor, in my mind, can go out and buy life insurance and health insurance. A health insurance policy with an accident rider is not unusual at all. So that leaves them with just having to buy disabilities insurance to insure themselves from that. That is difficult for them to get. You're actually talking to the one member of the committee who wanted to not include them at all, because my concern was that if without that balance in there, without an employer to challenge an employee who said he was injured at work, is you no longer have a gatekeeper or a safeguard, and so a sole proprietor could actually use workers' compensation as kind of part of a retirement plan. Now, that's a terrible thing to say, and that would be fraudulent if that happened. And the division told us that they thought they had plenty of safeguards in place, and they weren't terribly concerned about that. But we thought, well, we offered the amendment to raise the bar a little bit, that it wasn't just a sole proprietor, but it was at least a very small corporation or sole proprietor with a couple employees. The out-of-state health care provider, that had to do with enhancing compensation for the injured worker. And where the this would enhance it by 3%, what you would get monthly while you were being treated for the temporary disability. The way the statutes, somebody at some time in the past had written into the workers' compensation statutes that you would get this enhanced payment if you got your health care within the state. And I think they were that it was an effort to support the health care providers in the state, that they wanted to put an incentive in for that. So we didn't want to make that incentive perverse and irrational, so that's why we put the 100-mile differentiation in it. But then we had employers come to us and say, we have a contract with an out-of-state medical group and for workers who might be injured for orthopod services or something, we send them to Rapid City to somebody and they give us a special deal or something like that. Well, the employer had that, and so we didn't want the employee to be the one who was penalized by 3% because of an employer contract. So we excluded that as well. The last part of your question is I didn't quite fully understand it, but I think it had to do with confidentiality of the attorney's fees, and I'm not quite sure how to address that.
Representative Korber.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess I have two questions, and one is just maybe have been taken care of on page 7 through rule and regulation. But I'm just wondering on raising the age from 21 to 25 for children who are in educational institutions. So does that mean if they're enrolled in one night class, they're going to get to receive these benefits up to age 25? Or is there some level of enrollment that they have to be in order for them to receive the benefits? And then I do have an overall question on the fiscal note. I would, for my own clarification, if this bill is passed right now, the way the fund sits, will rates have to be increased this 1.1% as indicated on the fiscal note? And my third question, I am still concerned about the explanation regarding the sole proprietor, because my question is there. I understand the part about covering employees, but if you're a sole proprietor, you don't issue yourself a W-2 at the end of the year. You don't really take a regular paycheck. So how are you going, how are you going to know what to base your premium on that you're paying in? So I'm still have some confusion about the sole proprietor. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Chairman Landon.
Madam Chairman, concerning the raising of the age at which a child can continue to receive benefits for if their parent were killed on the job from 21 to 25. An example was two things were brought up. First off, it increased from 18 to 21, and that would provide enough time for those children who were going to trade school or a junior college, or who were just give them a year or two out on their own, and as kind of a transition time that a lot of that had they had parents, they might very well want to help support their child for that time. Going from 21 to 25 was taking into account a group of children that between high school and going to college, they leave for a two-year period and go on a mission, or they don't go into school right away. They might go out and try some life skill living and then go back to school. So that was just trying to match more some of the reality that and some of the variability that we saw out in society. And to give you some exact numbers, the going from 18 to 21, that benefit would actually increase the cost to the system by about $673,000. Going from 21 to 25 would increase the cost to the system by about $67,000. So that was the second one was relatively less expensive. Concerning the question on the rates and so on, this proposal actually, I think it comes out to 11 anticipated. It's come out to expect to cost the system about $11 million more dollars a year. And this last year, with the premiums that had been paid last year, and with the income from the fund that had been realized by investments, the fund even and a lot of those had not been in the stock market. This fund is primarily invested in bonds, and so that hasn't changed too much. Is there were $40 million paid in credits. So it's actually expected not to influence the, not to require a rate increase. And yet we tried as a committee, we tried not to look at the money. We tried to look at the reality of what the benefits people were getting and try to match that to reality. And in the end, we saw how the money came out, and we were satisfied with that. But we didn't want the fact that the fund is well-funded now to be our driver to adjusting benefits.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Try to answer some of the questions answered by some of the colleagues in my profession, because in a former life, I was on this committee, and through the interim. With respect to the attorney's fees and the confidentiality of attorney's fees, we had discussion and decided that if you were an attorney and you wanted to collect your attorney's fees from the state of Wyoming, you would have to make that disclosure or partial disclosure to the state of Wyoming of what your attorney's fees agreement was, in order to gain the benefits of the state of Wyoming participating in the attorney's fees disclosure. With respect to the question asked by my good friend from Teton County about the case that came out a couple years ago, that case is kind of an interesting case. It was a rider who was rock climbing and hurt his wrist rock climbing and then claimed workers' compensation benefits as the owner of a corporation, which in and of itself might illustrate some of the consequences of allowing proprietors and officers and corporations to get workers' compensation. But anyways, rock climbing any claimed benefits. And the Supreme Court, looking at our statutory definitions, said that sole proprietors and corporate officers were excluded from our definition of employee, and so then he couldn't get benefits. And then I did have a question, Madam Chairman, and that is, I'd like the good chairman to comment on the actuarial viability of the fund and the consequences of increasing or decreasing benefits by amendment to this bill, and what those consequences to the fund would be should we bring amendments to this bill.
Chairman Landon.
Madam Chairman, the fund right now is, just so everybody knows, it's over $1 billion. Now, that doesn't mean that there's $1 billion just sitting out there. That the actuaries looked at that and they said, judging from the amount of injuries that have already been promises paid for benefits and for getting people well, for hospital expenses, and most of the benefits are paid for medical benefits and not so much for indemnity. But judging from all of that, 900 and some million dollars will cover all of those promises. And so that amount that's above there is money that is actuarially over what is needed to cover those things. Right now, there is still some money above that. We all know what the economy's done. One of the things that happens with the Workers' Compensation Fund is that, and this is just a fact of the statistics of experience, is when an economy is in a bad shape, usually the demands on the workers' compensation system goes up. So right now we feel that it's in good shape. Right now we feel that it will continue to look like in good like it's in good shape. I would say amendments that would be brought in to affect some of the amendments on the standing committee amendments and on some of the things that have been changed in here, we could predict some of the actuarial impact. On any new proposals that would be brought, we'd have to do some quick requests to find out what that might be.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have a question in this discussion. On page 7, where they talk about the benefits going to children, this is one of the few places where you've got an actual dollar number. And whenever I see that in our code, I always worry about that because we forget to update them sometimes. And perhaps this is probably something that's happened here at 150 and it wasn't changed. And I noticed my question particularly relates to the fact that it seemed like you've done a good job throughout this bill to index things according to a wage rate or the inflation index or something like that. And, you know, maybe there's no way of indexing those kind of support payments, but it's just something that, you know, if we can straighten it out now, we don't have to go back 5 years from now and fix it. The only other question I have is on the bottom of page 10 and the top of page 11, where you talk about parents that might be receiving some financial support from the injured employee. Did you consider the possibility of some mischievousness or trickery when it comes to proving that or not, or making these kind of allegations, I guess? It seems like there's nothing in this code that would pertain to demonstrating the truth of that support. I guess those two questions is all I have.
Chairman Landon.
Madam Chairman, thank you for the questions from my good seatmate. The First off, considering the $250 per month payment for children, is you'll see at the bottom of that page that that is to be adjusted for inflation annually using the Consumer Price Index of the U.S. Department of Labor. And one of the amendments on the Standing Committee amendment also added at the end of that sentence, or 3%, whichever is less. The committee felt comfortable with this because inflation in the United States over time has averaged about 2.5%. So we felt that that would give the fund some protection and yet give the employee some protection. Concerning the question on defining at least half, right now the division has some definitions for substantially all. They're going to have to go back in and write rules, and it's probably going to have to do with going I can see where that could get to be a tricky question, and I'm not sure quite how they would discover that, but I think that there's probably means. Hopefully that'll be pretty straight. The best way would be to actually, if that individual was cutting his parents a check or something, if they were living with him, I could see where that might be problematic. So I think we've tried to define it more exactly, but it's going to be, there's probably going to be a lot of circumstances where rules and regulations will have to take care of that.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem.
Yep, Madam Chairman. My question's on page 16, on about line 10, that new language there. If the division or a hearing examiner determines an injured worker's failure to meet any procedural deadline is through the fault of the worker's attorney, yada, yada, yada. How often does this happen, I wonder? And what I'm wondering is, will that cause a lot more cost to the program as a result of that language?
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think it happens more often than we expect, but it hadn't. I don't think one of the things that I think that you're looking at that I appreciate is we don't want to build things in here that will accidentally drive behavior in a certain way that people will then take advantage of the system by doing certain things. We had heard that it extends the length of the hearings at the Office of Administrative Hearings, for one thing, because the attorneys don't meet the deadline. Otherwise, I have a recollection here. I had two nerve cells fire simultaneously. The one thing that is in this sentence that is something of a protective action here is it says the worker's failure to meet any procedural deadline on line 12 in this act is the fault of the worker's attorney. As we go back and look at the Workers' Compensation Act, there are not very many procedural deadlines in the act itself. So this won't pertain to a lot of other deadlines that have been created through rules and regulations, just those that are in the Act. And it should also be noted that it's our understanding, although it's not written here, it's our understanding that if it is the attorney's fault that he will not be paid for the services that he was supposed to have been providing, but obviously didn't by missing the deadline.
Is there any more discussion on the Standing Committee amendment? Question having been called, all those in favor?
Madam Chairman, the first one's going to be the question on Standing Committee amendment.
Yes.
Number one. Okay.
Yep, this is the question on the Standing Committee amendment number one. We're on House Bill 54. The question was called. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 54 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Is there any discussion? Question being, having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 54 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Bill Number 54 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Madam Chairman.
Mr. Speaker.
May I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, you may.
Madam Chairman, I would like to thank the Chairman of the House Labor Committee and the members of the Labor Committee, both past and present, for all their hard work on this bill. Thank you.
The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution 15. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Joint Resolution 15, introduced by Representative Wallace, a joint resolution proposing to amend the Wyoming Constitution relating to education, providing that the legislature for any appropriate educational program, removing the prohibition on providing funds to schools not under the absolute control of the state. This bill is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Peasley, Korberg, no, Begbie, Barbudo, Patton, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Gingrey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Joint Resolution 15 do pass. And I turn over the explanation to the representative from Campbell County.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I bring to you House Joint Resolution 15, and the primary reason for making these changes and for wishing to put this before a vote of the people is, from my perspective, is to be able to support, for the state to support early childhood care and education efforts, almost all of which are provided by private businesses and nonprofit organizations. Standing in the way are these archaic Blaine amendments. The Blaine amendments are the amendments in our Constitution that say no educational dollars shall ever go to any institution that isn't under the absolute control of the state, nor in any case shall it go to a sectarian institution. And a little bit of background on where those came from. In 1875, the U.S. House of Representatives, the Speaker of the House was a gentleman by the name of James G. Blaine. And he attempted to insert these amendments into the U.S. Constitution, and was unsuccessful in doing so. But at that point in history, all public schools were Protestant schools. And when the Catholics indicated that they would like to have some of the money for their schools in a anti-immigrant wave across the country, these amendments were inserted in almost every state's constitution, some of them more permissive than others. And something that I learned during the committee while we were dealing with this is that a tactic that was used in those days, apparently, and it's my suspicion that this may have been the case in Wyoming as well, is that when states came into the Union, if they did not have these Blaine amendments as part of their constitution, they weren't allowed into the Union. So, seven justices of the U.S. Supreme Court have recognized, along with a growing number of legal academics and historians, that the term sectarian was the code for Catholic, and that these things were added to the state constitutions in order to enforce the nativist bigotry of the day. all of these pose a potential threat to the adoption of school choice programs, despite the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Zelman versus Simon Harris, which made clear that the federal constitution permits such aid. So, the passage of this amendment removes that prohibition against educational appropriations to private or religious organizations. It allows for the state support of early childhood education. It allows deserving recipients of Hathaway scholarships or other state-appropriated higher education assistance to be able to attend institutions of higher education or career technical education that is not under the absolute control of the state. For instance, a Hathaway recipient could use their scholarship to attend a private technical school if that provided the best education for their intended career. And it does allow, it doesn't mandate, it doesn't create, but it would open the door for K-12 school choice, where state appropriation for the education of children could be used for educational purposes at private, for-profit schools, nonprofit schools, or parochial schools, not under the absolute control of the state. I would like to point out, actually, let me go back just a little bit, give you a little bit of background about how we approached this problem. I went to LSO and I said, here's what I would like to do. I would like to find a way to make the smallest, least amount of change to the Constitution that would allow for some state participation in especially preschool that is so often done in private and in nonprofit arenas. And this is the proposal that they came back to me with. And so to take you to the resolution yourself, it's fairly self-explanatory. It is a notwithstanding Article 1, Section 9, this is on page 2, starting on line 13, notwithstanding Article 1, Section 19, and Article 3, Section 36, two of the three Blaine amendments of this Constitution, the legislature may appropriate monies for education to be used for any age-appropriate, accredited, or generally accepted educational program that meets state standards. And then the other change, which is basically a deletion that begins on the top of page 3, removes some language that would be in conflict with it. And then it has the summary that this is the summary that would go along with it if it was an amendment that went before the voters. And this summary would say the adoption of this amendment will allow the legislature to appropriate funds for any appropriate educational program. Removes the prohibition on providing funds to schools that are not under the absolute control of the state. Would also remove the state constitutional prohibition on providing state funds for educational programs of private schools or institutions of learning controlled by churches or sectarian organizations. All such state actions would still be subject to applicable federal constitutional limitations. So there would, all of those federal constitutional limitations that are in place would still apply. And in fact, it does leave untouched the third Blaine Amendment in our Wyoming Constitution, which does not allow for any kind of sectarian instruction qualifications or tests to be tolerated in our schools. That's pretty much the resolution. And before I answer questions, if there are any, I would just say that, you know, I think most of us already have a pretty good idea where we stand on this issue. I really don't feel like we need to debate the merits one way or another for a lengthy period of time. We have 7 kids, my husband and I. I would say that the educational system, as it is, miserably failed 2 of them. And as parents, even though we could see what was happening, we had 0 choice to do anything about it. I would say that two others, those four kids, managed to become bright, happy, successful adults in spite of the system. And I emphasize in spite of the system. And only three out of those seven kids, could I say, were really well served by the traditional school system. And some will say that we can't open this door because it would destroy public education as we know it. I don't believe that is true. And in why I don't believe that is true, if you look at places where there has been some small modicum of school choice has occurred, in those places where they had absolutely pathetically terrible schools that were failing all of their kids, and they have instituted voucher programs so that those students could go to a different school, could go to a private school, that what has actually happened in those places is not only did those kids who got out of those absolutely awful schools find themselves in a better situation, but the schools they left behind improved enormously. A little bit of competition goes a long ways. And the public systems they left behind had fewer students that they could spread their resources over, and so they were able to actually create some quality in the public schools. So, like I said, I think we probably all know how we feel on this. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I rise in opposition to this joint resolution, and I will be brief. There's a quick, very quick and brief history lesson. I have not been able to find any specific reference in our history of the Constitutional Convention. If anybody wants to read it, LSO has a copy of the proceedings of the Wyoming Constitutional Convention from 1889. There was a strong emphasis in our Constitution on public education. What I did find in my quick research is comments of the delegate from Johnson County in 1889, who pretty much said, I don't put a lot of stock in these outside schools. If parents want to send their kids to private schools, they ought to, or to outside schools, they need to pay for it. That was the philosophy when our Constitution was written. And that is the basis for the amendment, or for the language in the Constitution that we have now, which is that public education money does not go to private or sectarian religious schools. Now, let's assume this passes. What does it do? What are the risks? It's not a minor change to how we do public education. It's a radical change to how we do education in this state. The proposed amendment does nothing to change the fact that education is considered a fundamental right in Wyoming. That's where all our school finance education cases come from. If education is a fundamental right, it's going to be a fundamental right whether you're going to private school, a religious school, or a public school, which means the funding has to be equal, unless you want to completely rewrite the Constitution. I think that that's a likely possibility. So I don't know what that does to school funding. I'll defer to the good folks from appropriations who understand the budget far better than me. And I understand everybody's frustration with the public education system. My kids have had great teachers. They've had bad teachers. They've had good experiences. They've had bad experiences. But the last thing I want to do for my children is gut public education. Where am I going to send them? And I live in Cheyenne. Am I going to ship them out of state to go to school? I mean, what? Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. We know there are things we don't like in education, but this is not going to help. Thank you.
Representative Jorgensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know enough about this topic to get too emotional in my comments, nor to be very extensive, but let me just say a few things. By my reading when we speak in the state about charter schools, we, for example, we always require some authorization or oversight by the local school district. When you look at schools across the country, and there are several locations, generally in large cities where there's a focused problem and an obvious problem, and those schools are taken over because they are failing so demonstrably, it's generally the city or the state that takes them over, because this is an extremely important advantage that I believe we have in the United States, which is a separation of church and state. And I don't mind putting all those issues on a ballot, but I think, as the good bringer of the resolution has said, let's not beat this to death, let's just vote on it. I would urge us to do that and vote no on the proposed resolution. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, Madam Chairwoman. I rise in support of the House Joint Resolution, and I do agree with the previous speaker. I won't speak very long. I believe that this is one step in the right direction for Wyoming in the option of opening up more school choice. I would challenge the previous speaker from Laramie County that monopolies never work, and more competition and choice in any system, including education, will bring about more changes than any of us in this body could ever do by passing any sundry number of statutes. Thank you.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I rise in support of this. I think any time you get some competition going, you're right. And I'd also remind this body that we're already doing this in the state, in one school that is getting state support that is a private school outside of Lander a little ways.
Representative Pedersen.
Nope.
Okay. Is there any more discussion on the bill? Representative Patton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Speaking on and against the House Joint Resolution Number 15, we're told that this is the primary purpose of it was for early education, but, and agreeably, it opens up much more. House Joint Resolution, how does competition in this particular case support and improve public education? By taking away funds from public education? I don't think that that's the way that we are charged. We are here by the Constitution to provide a free public education from age 6 to age 18. Maybe we should amend that, and maybe we should make it 5 or 4 or 3 or 2 to age 18. But our commitment is to public education, constitutionally and socially. Article 7, paragraph 4 on income says, shall be appropriated, the income shall be appropriated exclusively to the use and support of free public schools. I didn't change one word. Article 7, paragraph 6, states state to keep schools and invest trust funds in care of the state to be used for the exclusive benefit of public schools. Article 7, Section 7, income shall be used exclusively applied to the support of free schools in every county. Article 7, Section 9, provides taxation maintain efficient system of public schools free of charge. That's a part of the Constitution that isn't being addressed under Article 1 and Article 8 that are being proposed to be amended. I think on the very face of the proposition that we have before us, it's flawed. But whether it's flawed or whether it's not flawed, I think the discussion is our commitment to public education. And that commitment, if we have a problem with the local school district, why don't we visit with them? Why are we saying that you can't, we're going to change it here and that we know better than the elected representatives of each and every one of the unified school districts that we acquired in 1969. That was quite an advancement. One of the parties that was a major force to that was Harry Roberts. And for your information, he just passed away. And there will be a service in his honor on Friday. In respect of Harry and in respect of what was done in 1969 to try and get a quality educational opportunity for every child in this state, that stands, I think, in jeopardy with what's before you. We hear about competition from China, from India, and matter of fact, Indonesia, the four largest populated states in the world, the four most largest. Only one offers a free educational opportunity for every child in this country. Only one. This is ours. I cherish it. I ask your support in what I cherish and defeat House Joint Resolution number 15.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In our Judiciary Committee, we actually spent quite a while on this one, and we learned a lot of history. The history lesson that we received was in regards to Speaker Blaine. He was the Speaker of the House in the late 1800s, and any state wishing to enter into the Union, in their constitution, they had to put in these Blaine amendments. They're also referred to in a lot of the literature as just simply anti-Catholic amendments. They were meant, and what Blaine was attempting to do, the public schools at that time were run primarily by Protestants. They were concerned with any money going to Catholic schools. And so these anti-Catholic amendments were placed into the Constitution. I signed on to this bill because I don't think we should ever have bigoted provisions in our Constitution aimed at any one religion. And even though Speaker Blaine did that over 100 years ago, we still have a chance to fix that. Whether or not I agree with vouchers or that type of stuff, I don't know. But the point is that we can't even have a debate on school choice in this state until these amendments are removed. And I would urge you to vote aye for this bill.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. First off, I'd like to point out that we aren't changing anything about establishing and maintaining a complete and uniform system of public education with the free elementary and with the all the way through the university. But there's a lot of parents and there's a lot of students and there's a lot of teachers who are dissatisfied with what we're doing now. But unfortunately, we have a monopolistic system. And if your children aren't doing well, is the only option they have is to drop out and go do something else. And that's too bad. And we're losing 20% of our kids that way, and some school districts higher, and we're saying we can't do any better than that. The problem with having a monopolistic system is it's actually written into a uniform system. I heard somebody speak that said, you know, we keep trying to make narrower the performance of our students, when in fact what we should be doing is trying to make that broader and let those students who really have capability and talent blow the roof off. And so the reason that I would like for you to consider support of this is actually a driver towards quality. What else in our society do we have that is a monopoly that doesn't in some way stifle creativity and innovation? And there's just no way that those things can go along. I could envision a group of three teachers taking on a group of 15 students and making contracts with their parents and saying, this is what we're going to do this year. And since you all are interested, let's say, in engineering, by the end of the 3 years that we're going to be doing things is as part of our contract, we're going to guarantee that you're going to be able to pass the requirements to get into MIT. You know, I just think that we have so much room for innovation, so much room for creativity, and unless we can get out of this model that we're in and allow there to be other things experimented with, I'm afraid we're locked into a situation, and at this time, with other countries coming on the way they are, I don't care if they don't have a free system of education. The fact of the matter is that India and China are rolling out more engineers and more scientists, and our very quality of living and lifestyle in the future is going to be in jeopardy without freeing education in the United States. So on and for the resolution.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was going to wait till third reading. Just a majority needs to pass this on committee of the whole, and then, of course, two-thirds on third reading. But, you know, I think it's fun to talk about if you read The World is Flat and other, and when you talk about India and China, and, of course, India has more preschoolers than we have in our entire country. And but I think it's important to realize why most of the world now, the entire world is learning English, and why the entire world is trying to replicate Silicon Valley, and why the entire world sends their best and brightest here to be educated. And we can talk about the numbers of engineers and the numbers of that, but America has chosen, first of all, we're on top. It's unequivocal. And it's because of our free and public education system. It's the foundation of our democracy. And as far as to go with, let's talk about India or China, there'll be a generation of 20, 30, 40 million kids thrown away in India. We don't do that in America. We educate every child, and it's very expensive. And so when we start saying, well, a free public education, well, that's not the answer. It's made America great. It's been the foundation that's lifted poor kids up, and it's provided for a very important middle class in this country. Second thing, I heard this about preschools. I'm not buying that. We have it within our statute now to establish partnerships with preschools. But let's just talk about public education. We all have horror stories. I remember when a guidance counselor told me in high school, she says, I don't think he wants to go to college. She told a college recruiter, I don't think Steve wants to go to college. He just thinks it's a thing to do. I mean, you know, come on. And how many of you have had a bad teacher? Yeah, we've all had a bad teacher, but that's the human condition. We've all had experiences. But to say something like this is going to fix education? Come on. And so I would just say to you that, you know, I think look at the big picture. Really, here's how students, the number one data supporting student achievement is the wealth of the parents. Number one. Number one, every county, every city in America, parents who have money, their kids do better. Now, there's a whole other bunch of issues why, but they probably value education. They take their kids on trips. They experience more. They read to their kids, yada, yada. But the number one predictor of student success is parents' money. And then, of course, another predictor is the involvement of parents. And we see that all the time. We see it in our public schools in Casper that are choice schools. We have the top performing school in the state, a public school choice. But parents are involved and they sign contracts and they do tremendous amounts of work. And they know who they are and what they're about, and it's a back to basics curriculum. That's great, and it's in a public school environment. But parents are involved. So to say that something like this, which could have far reaching ramifications, is going to fix education, I just don't buy it. And there's other ways to get a choice to work at things, but I just don't think this is the way. And so whether we defeat this with two-thirds on third reading or defeat it now, I'd urge your no vote on this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Byrd.
Madam Chairman, thank you. On and against the amendment, on and against the bill. I believe that this does nothing but dilute the funding and distract from the purpose of our public schools. We have an institution in place that may need some work, but to add options of other people coming in and taking away from the funds that are vitally needed in this area to keep our students competitive on the international market is just unthinkable at this point. We have issues with the public school system. We should address those directly. But to allow every group with an agenda to come in and try to dip money out of this fund is just unconscionable at this time when we need to actually use all of this funds to get the public schools back on the course where they need to be. So at this point, I'd like to call for the question.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Fundamental question. Do you, in your heart of hearts, believe that parents should have an opportunity to consider alternatives if the school system is not working for their individual child? That's what my hope is. I hope that we turn from a society and a state that is trying to save the system to a society and a state that tries to look at individual students and leaves the choice with the families. So that's the fundamental question here. Do we put this in front of the voters and say, I have a choice. I have something that I can do if my child is not being well served?
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On and against House Joint Resolution 15 for a couple of reasons. One, changing the Constitution is a very serious matter, number one. And when I recall the tort reform debates, we had a special session on tort reform. And we spent thousands of hours looking at that issue. At the very least, this resolution should be in front of the Education Committee on an interim study, I believe. And secondly, I think that we should look harder at reforming the system we have and be more receptive to changes to that system than I see. Because when I see changes to that system that come up or innovative ideas, I see a great resistance to that. And sometimes I'm frustrated by that. And that's what drives this whole debate. Let's be receptive to innovation and change in the system we have to make it better. It's the second best funded system in America. Funding is not everything, obviously. Let's be proactive. Let's look at it seriously. And we have bills in front of us this session that some are small changes and some are significant changes like this one. But they need the same type. They need good review in the committees, and we need to look towards really what are we doing. We'll be into recalibration in 2010 and 2011, and we can make changes. We have the system, and let's work towards that rather than saying we can't change the system we've created and we're so frustrated by it we're going to fund something else that the Constitution says we will never change. You don't see the word ever in the Constitution very often, but you see it in this bill. Page 3, line 2. Nor shall any portion of any public school fund ever be used. Now, that's a pretty clear statement, and I don't see that it is discriminatory towards one religion or the other. It talks about all religions, whether it was the Blaine Amendments or not. So that's my take on it. Thanks.
Representative Lubno.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As usual, when I'm at a loss for thoughts, I look to my predecessors, the folks upon whose great shoulders I stand upon, and I look to the wisdom of our third president quite often, who said, education is placed among the articles of public care. Not that it would be proposed to take its ordinary branches out of the hands of private enterprise, which manages so much better all concerns to which it is equal, but a public institution can alone supply those sciences which, though rarely called for, are necessary to complete the circle, all parts of which contribute to the improvement of the country, some of them to its preservation. And if you read the third president's wisdom, what he says, and what I quoted to you before, is that for us to maintain our republic, we have to raise everybody's educational level to the highest possible level that we can do that. And he's a great fan, or was a great fan, of the free enterprise system and keeping everything in free enterprise with everything except education. And education, he said, was the responsibility of the state to ensure the survival of the democracy. I see, with all due respect to the good colleague who lives a few miles to the north of me, I see this as a tool to fractionalize our educational system and to divide up the system so that we don't have a common education, which is the tie that binds our country together. And so I'd urge the defeat of this amendment at this stage. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Representative Patton.
I need to dispel one thought that we have a monopoly. We have created a public system, but it's not a monopoly. And I refer to Section 9, Taxation for Schools. Goes on, I won't read the whole thing and bore you with it. But they shall attend a public school during the period between 6 and 18 years for a time equivalent to 3 years. Perhaps we should change that, but comma, unless educated by other means. And my good friend from Sheridan County lives in a county in which there are other means. There are at least 4 private institutions, 1 parochial, maybe 2 of them are parochial, and 2 others private. The question before you is, should they be funded by public funds? And I suggest that the Speaker of the House spoke most eloquently that we need to understand, we need to support, and we need to assist in with understanding the changes of public education as the time has evolved. You know, it's been almost 30-some years since 1969 since a real adjustment to that has occurred. So perhaps what we have brought before us is the issue that maybe we ought to pay attention to some changes. But this one certainly is not it.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This very brief story, no applause, this very brief story will illustrate my feelings toward this resolution. There was this very young little girl, about 4 years old, sitting in the doctor's office waiting to be immunized. And she started screaming, "No, no, no." And her mother was horrified. She says, "Honey," trying to calm her, you know, "that's not polite behavior." So the little girl calmed for a second, thought for just a little bit, and then start screaming even louder, "No, thank you! No, thank you! No, thank you!" And thank you.
Okay. Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Joint Resolution 15 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
It is the opinion of the chair that the noes have it. So pursuant to House Rule 10-5-5B, The bill having failed, a voice vote, a standing division vote is required. All those in favor, please stand. Those opposed, please stand. Okay. Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Anderson. Bagby. Barbudo. Berger. Berger. Blake. Bonner. Brechtel. Brown. Buchanan. Byrd. Kennedy. Carson. Childers. Cohey. Connolly. Kraft. Davison. Dirks. Edmonds. Esquivel. Gilmore. Gingery. Goggles. Hales. Hallinan. Hammonds. Harshman. Harvey. Illaway. Yagi. Jorgensen. Landon. Lockhart. Lubno. Madden. McKim. McComey. Mercer. Meyer. Miller. Millen. Moniz. Patton. Peasley. Pedersen. Peterson. Philp. Korberg. Roscoe. Semlich. Shepperson. Stewart. Stubson. Teeters. Thompson. Throne. Wallace. Zwanitzer Dan. Zwanitzer Dave. Mr. Speaker. Berger. Berger. Berger excused. I'm about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Hallinan? No to aye. Are there any other changes? Throne? The vote is closed. 12 aye, 47 no, 1 excused.
Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, House Joint Resolution 15 having failed, a roll call vote is indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 174. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 174, introduced by Representative Yagi, an act relating to the Hathaway Student Scholarship Program. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubno, McKim, McComey, Teeters. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman McComey?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill Number 174 do pass, and I further move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, which I will explain at this time, if, with your permission, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, the Standing Committee Amendment is to page 2, line 21. It's a kind of a clarification. And what we've done is on line 21, we've struck a 10 so that it reads, the line reads like this. And the student may use this scholarship while attending a Wyoming community college or University of Wyoming. I call for the question if there's no question on the amendment.
You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Yes. Question being called. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 174 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If everyone would look in your box, you have a thing on top of it. It's the Hathaway Scholarship Levels and Eligibility Requirement. There's a front and a back to this sheet, and this is just a good informative sheet explaining the Hathaway Scholarship. It also explains the bill that we have before it, so if you would look at that, and you might just say that as a lot of reference is made to the Hathaway Scholarship, And this is just a real good explanation of the four levels. And then on the back, it talks about the requirements for each level. So this is just a very informative sheet. What I'd like you to look at is on the sheet that has the four levels on top, career, opportunity, performance, and honors, look at that one. And in the career space, right up on top, it says right underneath careers, certificate or applied science degree only at Wyoming community colleges. What this bill does is this language was put in a year after the Hathaway Scholarship was put in place, and it kind of changed it. So if you get a career scholarship, you can only get a career or science tech degree, applied science degree. And one of my constituents came to me and said, my daughter, this just happened last year, my daughter went to one of our community colleges, registered for music, wanted to get a degree, associate's degree at community college, and then go to UW. And in October, they called her in and said, I'm sorry, but you're in the career ladder. You cannot get an associate's degree. And so what we're doing is we are allowing the kids that get the career scholarship to go on and get an associate's degree. And that's about as simple as it is. I think the education committee meant that to be, and for some reason it just got put in there, and this is the way it is at present. So what we're trying to do is just, we call this the Provisional Opportunity Hathaway Scholarship, and it allows students to, with a career scholarship, to continue up the line and get an associate's degree and go to UW and hopefully get a degree. So this is just letting those kids have that opportunity. That's kind of the simplest definition at this late date. This, and I guess I would just ask for if there's any questions or the question.
Okay. Question being called. I'm sorry, Representative Hammonds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question would be, and this is, we're going back in time, and this is difficult to jump into the discussion at this point, but if you go down on that career level, what you're going to see is that they have a minimum GPA in high school of a 2.5. So that's a C-plus grade average from our Wyoming high schools. And you have a 17 on the ACT. What those two things tell you is that you're not ready for college-level work. In other words, you say you want to go for an associate's while you're arriving at the doorstep, and you are not adequately prepared to be successful for that. So when all of you talk about, gosh, all these kids are arriving in college and they're taking all these remedial classes, this is one of the students who, if they started an associate's degree program, would have to take remedial classes. We know that from a 17 ACT, and quite frankly, having a 2.5 in our Wyoming high schools is not an indicator that you're ready to do a degree program that gets you towards an AA. Now, my question for the bringer of the bill is, this was set up for those students thinking that they would want technical careers. And so your provision, how would it handle how much remediation it was indicated that they would need? They only have so many semesters that they can take with the Hathaway. And so how many semesters would they have to take of remediation before they'd be able to actually be able to fully use their Hathaway? I guess that's my question for you. How would it actually work for these kids who aren't ready for college level work?
Representative Yagi.
Thank you. And thank you for the question. Let me explain this little girl that we're talking about here. She was a student in high school that was in band, in the theater. She was in student council, and she just had a hard time taking tests. And I don't know if any of you remember that back that far. I was one of those kids that had a hard time taking tests. And to get a 15 or a 17, and I wasn't the most attentive. But this little girl was one of those kids that really tried hard. And to say that she's going to need lots of remediation, I think there's a little question there. But going back to the remediation given for the opportunity and for the performance and for the honors, there are remediation for those. And this is only 4 years, so if you're using some of your time for remediation, you're going to have to make up some time. But bless their hearts, these kids that want to excel, let's give them that opportunity, and that's what this is for. So I think it's built in that you have your time, and if you have to take a remedial class, so be it. I would suggest this little girl isn't going to have to do that as hard a working as she is, but let's give them the opportunity, and that's what this is trying to do.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On in support of the bill, I guess I am a co-sponsor, and in support of my prime sponsor. Back to the select committee days on merit scholarships, we debated this issue quite extensively, and we really couldn't come to an agreement, and we thought, well, what's the difference between a kid taking getting a drafting certificate, and a kid who's taken like a pre-architecture course or curriculum? Really not much. Most of the classes are the same. So we went back and forth. We kind of left it alone. Then we came back and added some amendments where those kids in the career could, on completion of the certificate, earn 2 more years. So that really, I don't see any fiscal note at all, because these kids have already earned 2 more years at our community college. And I just think of this as, and I've kind of, it's been a while warming up to it, but this is the old for the kid who gets on fire late part. And I just think, and we've had a lot of passionate debate about that in this body, but you know, if the kid is not quite college ready when he started, maybe he's growing up a little bit, if he has to take some remedial, it's on his dime because he's 2 years out of high school. Won't affect the bill that just passed House Education. A very good bill, I might add, that you all look at later. But so I don't see any harm. The only thing you could probably argue about, well, these kids get into the scholarship track with a little lower requirements because they don't have the full success curricula. They have a lower ACT requirement. But the first 2 years are spent in a degree certificate program. And then once they kind of get out and the guy's like been turning wrenches and saying, you know, I might want to have my own business where I got others working for me while we work on cars or whatever. And so that's kind of part of this, I think. And so I really see this as fitting a niche for several kids and really no harm to our budget or, I think, the integrity of the program. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was another issue that arrived on our doorstep when we did the Hathaway. We have these children that are wanting to go into the community colleges and pursue arts and music, and guess what? The numbers aren't right for this type of thing, so they couldn't qualify. They couldn't use their Hathaway to pursue music and the arts, and this is another vehicle that allows this.
Any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report to do so with the recommendation that House Bill 174 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
House Bill 174 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Throne.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Privilege of the floor.
I guess. Thank you. Yes.
Have no fear. I'm not going to give anybody a lecture on any constitution. I am just simply here to tell you that I have taken it upon myself to order the mugs for the 60th legislature. Those of you who know me, and perhaps those of you who have seen my desk, that this is an organizational task that might be outside my skill set, but I believe that I can accomplish it for this year. So except that I can't manage to send all of you an email to tell you this information. But in any event, I'll have the price tomorrow. Just come speak to me. If we get them ordered by Friday or Monday, we'll have them before the end of the session. And if anyone wants to, any of the new members want to come see one, I have one on my desk. Thank you.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 250. Will the reading clerk read the bill?
House Bill 250, introduced by Representative Muniz, an act relating to municipal fire chiefs after end of term. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Hales, Illaway, Lubno, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan. No, Dirks. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 250 do pass, and I will turn the explanation of the bill over to the good representative from District 46.
Representative Moniz.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. excuse me. This is an addition to the statute 15-5-105, Employment and Appointments Generally, Appointment of Fire Chiefs, creating a new subsection, D. If any member of the fire department is appointed fire chief, he shall remain on the list of eligible persons certified, and his classification remains the same at the end of his term as fire chief. This wording is very similar to what's in the statute now relating to police chiefs. In the statute, it says if any member of the police department is appointed chief of the police, he shall remain on the list of eligible persons certified, and his classification remains the same at the end of his term as police chief. So it's very similar, almost identical, actually, to what exists. The reason this is being brought forward, the problem that it creates is the lack of rights for the fire chief to return to the rank for reasons that he may be dismissed for whatever reason and therefore cannot complete or receive a full pension. The effect of this lack of protection is that many young officers will not risk their careers at the present time to compete for the job of fire chief from a qualified pool of applicants. Fire chiefs are at-will employees in most all of our communities and can be dismissed without cause. Basically, what this does is give them the opportunity to return back to that eligibility list and fulfill their retirement. Without being able to do that, their retirement would end at whatever level they are and would not receive a full pension. And, Madam Chairman, with that, I would stand for any questions.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was just wondering if there had been any consideration in committee or had you considered how long the person should remain the same at the end of his term of office. Do you think that he should remain a fire chief forever or with the training requirements and whatnot, if at the end of the term of your office you should remain a fire chief for a certain number of years or something like that?
Representative Moniz.
Representative Landon, he would return to the rank at which he left when he was appointed fire chief. So if he had whatever time he had left on his pension, he would probably stay in there until that time he chose to retire.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 250 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 250 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 204. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 204, introduced by Representative Miller, an act relating to taxation and revenue, excess tax collections. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Samlek, No, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 204 do pass. There is a Committee of the Whole amendment. I would move Committee of the Whole amendment number Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 204, which changes a little bit of the wording, and I'd turn the explanation of the bill and the sales job over to the Fremont County Legislator.
I'd like to call, yes, question on the amendment. You've heard that question. The Standing Committee Amendment, let's see. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 204, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 204 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a good government bill, excess tax collections. It's come from a need we've seen for years. Our county treasurer in Fremont County suggested this bill, and I've been concerned about this for a number of years. And what we're talking about are these 1 cent addition taxes in the local counties. It's a special purpose tax where the voters approve the collection of a specific dollar amount for a specific project. For example, $5 million for a library. And so we put this tax, we collect the sales tax for an amount of time, and then the tax reaches the amount. And it used to be where we could cut off the tax on a monthly basis. So until a few years ago, we didn't collect a lot in excess of the amount that the voters agreed to. Well, with the streamlined sales tax agreement of a few years ago, we agreed in that to only do the cutoffs on a quarterly basis. So the tax continues to get collected sometimes for even more than one quarter because of the time they're notified to the time the department gets the tax shut off. Sometimes you collect a great deal of extra money. In the case in Fremont County, the special purpose tax that we had a year ago, they collected $3 million extra of a $10 million tax. What this bill does, it cuts it off. If you took it to the voters for a special purpose tax and you said you wanted $10 million to do whatever you wanted to do, build this project, you collect the tax up to that amount, that group gets that money to do their project, and the money collected in excess goes into a fund that accumulates interest and will be available for the next special purpose tax that the voters in the county vote on. So basically, you're giving somewhat of a tax refund back. Normally, we would like to give that refund back to the people that paid the tax, but in the case of these sales taxes, we don't really know who they are. It's everyone that paid that extra 1% for 3 or 4 months after the full amount had been collected. So that's the bill summary. If there's no special purpose tax during the next 5-year period, this money will get distributed into that county in a normal in the normal way any money gets distributed on a per capita basis to the cities, towns, and the county. So that's what the bill does. I'll just walk you briefly through the bill. I know everyone wants another long debate here. On page 2 of the bill, the new language is from lines 11 through 24. And on line 12 is where the amendment, the Standing Committee amendment, comes in. Any amount collected in excess of the amount, and the Standing Committee amendment changed, removed the next 5 words and inserted authorized to make it clear that the tax gets cut off once the $10 million is collected, or $5 million, or $2 million. Whatever they want, put it in there. If they want $3 million, but they think they might need a little bit more, maybe they need $4 million, just ask for $4 million. Let the voters know what you really want. Before we amended it, it said required to complete the project, which was rather vague and left it kind of open. So in committee, we changed that wording to authorized. We changed that wording later also to authorize in a similar position. The new language basically says the funds will go into an interest-bearing account. If no special purpose project comes forward, it gets divvied out to the county in the proportion that the population of the county situated outside the corporate limits of the cities and towns bears to the total population of the county, and to each city and town within the county in the portion the population of the city or town bears to the population of the county. So that's what the bill does. It's good government. It's what the voters vote for. It gets distributed in the proper way. It gets collected up to the amount the voters voted for, and it stops. Then the money accumulates for the next special purpose vote. So I ask for your support of this bill, and if there's no questions, I call for the question.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm sorry, I don't get it yet. If funds and accrued interest earned in the account are not spent on a specific purpose project within the next 5-year period immediately following the completion of the specific purpose project, the funds and accrued interest shall be restricted to use for the construction of roads. When it says on line 18, are not spent on a specific purpose project within the 5-year period immediately following the completion of the special purpose project, is that talking about the same special purpose project?
Representative Miller.
Madam Chairman. It applies to the money for the special purpose project has already been given to the special purpose project, and they've spent their money. This applies to the money that was collected in excess of the money that the 1% was being collected for. It goes into this fund. If there's no new special purpose projects in the intervening 5 years, then it flows into the county's and city's coffers to be used for those purposes.
Mr. Speaker.
Madam Chairman, thank you. What happens if the initial specific purpose project is over budget? So you have the vote on a $10 million project and it's $10.5 million. What happens to the excess? Does that go to fund it?
Representative Miller.
Madam Chairman and Mr. Speaker, yes, it does. It goes to that project right now. This has been real controversial in Fremont County just recently because they went way over budget. They said, well, the money's there. Just let us have it. And we let them have it. What we're doing here is telling them if they want more than $3 million or $5 million or $50 million, ask for it and be honest to the voters.
Mr. Speaker.
Madam Chairman, how does the bill do that?
Representative Miller.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Speaker, it cuts them off. If they've gone to the voters for $10 million, they get $10 million. They don't get $17 million.
Madam Chairman, again, can you show me where in the bill that would achieve, where there's language that would achieve that end?
Representative Miller.
Madam Chairman, I believe that's lines 11 and on down. Starts at line 11. It reads, any amount collected in excess of the amount authorized shall be held by the county treasurer in interest-bearing account and shall be expended only for a specific purpose project approved by the voters as provided in this paragraph in the 5-year period immediately following the completion of the specific purpose project.
Madam Chairman, so I'm sorry I didn't track the standing committee amendment. I see that any amount authorized. So if $10 million is authorized and it costs $10,500,000 to complete the project, they only get three quarters of a roof? Or I don't know how it works, but I understand the point. But I know in my own county, we've had this debate about the special purpose, and costs go up, and you can't meet the bid, or the bid is no longer held to by the contractor, and it's already been voted on, and then you're in another quagmire too. I was looking at school bonding issues and asked the question of LSO, if there are excess school monies available, can they be used for like things? And because I was looking at a bill to clarify that, and there was an attorney general's opinion that said, yes, they could be used for like things, for capital construction and even maintenance of those. So I see this as, this bill is an absolute bar to use of any funds over the authorized amount, right? Okay, thank you.
Representative Miller.
Madam Chairman, that's correct. It puts a limit to it. It still goes to that county, and out of these specific funds, they can't be used to backfill any overage that they have, but the county or whatever group this building has been built for, I'm sure they can probably figure out a way to complete that roof. What I'm trying to do here with this bill is make sure that they get the full cost of the project in there. If they need to put a fund in to pay for maintenance of the building, ask for it up front. Don't use the 30 or 40% extra collected to backfill it like we have been doing. So, again, we take this to the voters. They vote for $10 million, and we collect $13 million or $14 or $15 million. Is that right? I don't think so.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And Madam Chairman, part of the problem, it goes back to the cutoff that the good sponsor talked about earlier, and the fact that in our particular county, I believe it was over $1 million wound up $3 million by the time we could make the cutoff and comply with the law. But more was collected, and so. I didn't retract the amendment in. I thought what this bill was going to do is, because you can't go out and let a project till you know you've got the bond issue done. And if when you finally get the bond issue and then you let the project and the bids come in high, then you could have need some of that extra money. And I thought the way this bill was that would cover this, but after 5 years, this money had to be kept, and after 5 years, then the money could be used for something else, such as roads or something else that the commissioners, or if the city was a city project, the city was a sponsor, they could use it for that way. Is that the way the bill is now since it's been amended, my fellow sponsor?
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Basically, whatever they voted for, it cuts off. The money still goes to the county and is going to be available for that next project if there's one in the intervening years. If there's not, the money and the interest flows to the county for that specific purpose. That's extra money the county wasn't planning on. So it could still, they can't use that specific money to complete the project, but it frees up money in other areas of county or city government to possibly complete a project. Again, if they need more money, just ask for it in the original vote. The voters will probably give it to you. If they like it for $10 million, they'll probably give you $12
million. Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think I'm warming up to the bill, but why don't you allow a contingency or at least require when the amount that is authorized is voted on includes a contingency. I mean, we have contingencies built into all of the other major capital construction stuff we do. Have you thought about that? Would you entertain an amendment to do that? But on the other hand, by saying this is what you voted on, this extra money came in, you can't use it on what you voted on, but you can use it on some other stuff, that seems a bit contrary to to the whole concept of the vote on the tax itself. I think maybe as a taxpayer, I'd be more inclined to say, yeah, go ahead and use it on the project I voted on within some parameters rather than just go use it for something else.
Representative Miller.
Madam Chair, that putting a 10% contingency upon what the electors approved, I think it's maybe a good idea. Again, right now, in the case of the most recent one in Fremont County, we collected 30% extra. And they're actually, I don't know if they plan for this stuff, but every one of these seems to be collecting greatly in excess what they've asked for. And again, in Fremont County, one of the projects, they weren't even tracking what the thing was cost. They made some mistakes in the billing, and it ended up being a quite big error. Now, their bacon was saved because they had all this extra money. But they need to manage that business of using these government funds, these public funds, better than they are.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. To me, it's simple. And I think this is a good bill. I think it's something that's needed. A project's proposed to the voters. There's a number that's associated with it. That number ought to include the contingencies. It ought to include anticipated overruns, anything it needs. And that's what they're saying. Put the whole number in there, whatever it may be, hedge against overruns and extra costs to the extent you may wish, and put that in there as the number. The problem is the county clerk can't decree throughout the land when the last penny's collected that's going to fund that number, whatever it is. It's always going to overrun. The treasurer. And the treasurer cannot shut it off precisely when the last penny's collected. So it's always going to overrun. And the issue here is what happens to the overrun. And the overrun shouldn't be used to fund the project, because the entire project, including all the contingencies, overruns, and whatever, should have been built in the original number. So what's going to happen to the overrun? Is it just some sort of a slush fund in the county, or does it have a dedicated purpose? And this says it's not a slush fund. It says if another project, similar in nature, authorized by the voters, comes up within 5 years, plow this into that, which is going to reduce the amount the taxpayers have to pay on the next one. If it doesn't come up within 5 years, then it's got some strict restrictions on what that money can be used for. So it's not just an undedicated slush fund out there that's available to fund things that were never contemplated. So on and for the bill.
Representative Roscoe.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On and for this thing, I have to stand up for the contractors, having been involved in some of this stuff. It's good to stay on the budget of the project. Also, what happens is the public tends to grow a project if it lasts for a few years. And so even though the public may have agreed to pay $10 million, they keep asking for an extra swimming pool added onto this rec center. So this would keep that in line as well. I think it's a good idea. On and for the bill.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 204 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 204 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye. Opposed, no. The motion carries. Chairman McComey. You may have privilege.
Madam Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, you may.
Madam Chairman, in the south balcony over here is the longest standing president of the community colleges in Wyoming, my friend, and somebody's taught me a lot about community colleges, Joanne McFarland. Would you give her a hand?
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem? Or Mr. Speaker?
Will the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 41, recommended do pass. House Bill 42, amended, recommended do pass. Representative Buchanan moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again. House Bill 127, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 130, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 54, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 15, I'm sorry, House Joint Resolution 15, following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill 174, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 250, recommended do pass. House Bill 204, amended, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Millen, Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report has been adopted. Thank you very much, Representative Millen. Appreciate it. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 181. Mr. Speaker, the bill just below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 14, State Historic Sites Appropriation. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 182. Mr. Speaker, the bill just below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 17, Mental Health and Substance Abuse Appropriations. Ayes 24, no 6. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 183. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 28, Licensing of Entertainment Activities. Ayes 28, no 2. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 56, School Finance Appropriations. Ayes 27, noes 3. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 185. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 92, Long-Term Care Access. Ayes 26, noes 4. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 186. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 104, Life Insurance Limitation on Dependent Coverage. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 187. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 111, First Responder Retirement Contributions. Ayes 16, noes 14. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 188. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below failed to pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 128, Scrap Metal Purchases. Ayes 14, noes 16. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Mr. Speaker, a motion to reconsider the bill listed below failed to pass the Senate by the vote indicated. Senate File 128, Scrap Metal Purchases. Ayes 12, noes 18. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Thank you, Mr. Reading Clerk. That was interesting. We're at that order of business of introduction, reading, and reference of bills. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 304.
House Bill 304, introduced by Representative Jorgensen.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to taxation and revenue, lodging tax, statewide imposition.
House Bill 304 is referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. We're at that order of business of Senate files on introduction, reading, and reference of bills. First Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 19.
Senate File 19, introduced by the Mental Health Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to emergency detention and involuntary hospitalization costs.
Senate File 19 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 25.
Senate File 25, introduced by the Judiciary Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to criminal procedure, district courts, release of information.
Senate File 25 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 61.
Senate File 61, introduced by the Judiciary Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to registration of sex offenders.
Senate File 61 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 46.
Senate File 46, introduced by the School Facilities Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to school buildings, school district facility, lease fees, limitations.
Senate File 46 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 47.
Senate File 47, introduced by the Education Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Hathaway Student Scholarship Program Administration.
Senate File 47 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 56.
Senate File 56, introduced by the Education Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to school finance appropriations.
Senate File 56 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 21.
Senate File 21, introduced by the Agriculture Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to subdivisions located within irrigation districts.
Senate File 21 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 34.
Senate File 34, introduced by the Agriculture Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to administration of government, beginning Agricultural Producer Finance Authority.
Senate File 34 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 37.
Senate File 37, introduced by the Agriculture Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to antifreeze and petroleum products.
Senate File 37 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 68.
Senate File 68, introduced by the Select Water Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to water development projects, omnibus water bill construction.
Senate File 68 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. The next bill for consideration, Senate File 69.
Senate File 69, introduced by the Agriculture Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to fertilizer.
Senate File 69 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 4.
Senate File 4, introduced by the Travel Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to state parks and cultural resources regarding Fort Bridger.
Senate File 4 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 5.
Senate File 5, introduced by the Travel Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to state parks and cultural resources involving South Pass City.
Senate File 5 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 6.
Senate File 6, introduced by the Travel Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Wyoming Arts Council revisions.
Senate File 6 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 42.
Senate File 42, introduced by the local government.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Legislature Select Committee on Local Government Financing.
Senate File 42 is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 38.
Senate File 38, introduced by the Transportation Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Federal Real ID Act.
Senate File 38 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 59.
Senate File 59, introduced by the Transportation Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to road closure.
Senate File 59 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 60.
Senate File 60, introduced by the Transportation Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the National Guard Youth Challenge Program.
Senate File 60 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 22.
Senate File 22, introduced by the Mineral Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Wyoming Economic Development Act.
Senate File 22 is referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 44.
Senate File 44, introduced by the Mineral Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Public Service Commission regarding pipeline inspection and safety.
Senate File 44 is referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. The last bill for consideration is Senate File 75.
Senate File 75, introduced by the Mineral Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the economic development account.
Senate File 75 is referred to committee number 9, Minerals. Re-referrals? Let's do reports from standing committees first, please. Mr. Reading Clerk.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 69, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Philp, Stewart, signed Representative Philp, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 108, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Philp, Stewart, signed Representative Philp, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 161, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Philp, Stewart, signed Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 194, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Philp, Stewart, excused, Harshman, signed Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 213, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Pedersen, Philp, Stewart. No, Harshman, Jorgensen. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 234, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Pedersen, Philp, Stewart. No, Hammonds, Jorgensen. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 239, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Philp, Stewart. Signed, Representative Philp, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 4, Education, to whom is referred House Bill 218, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubnow, McKim, McComey, Teeters. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 4, Education, to whom is referred House Bill 269, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Kraft, Lubnow, McComey, Teeters. No, Connolly, Dirks, McKim. Excused, Yagi. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 70, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Wallace, Wanitzer, Dan. No, Moniz, Semlek, Teeters. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom is referred House Bill 129, respectfully reports the same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Wallace, Wanitzer, Dan. No, Semlek, Teeters. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 279, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Dirks, Illaway, Lubnow, Miller, Stepson, Wanitzer, Dan. No, Hales. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 281, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Lubnow, Stepson, Swanitzer, Dan. No, Miller. Signed, Representing Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 266, respectfully reports back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Goggles, Landon, Millen. No, Hallinan, Harvey, Shepperson. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Reading Clerk. Re-referrals. Chairman Landon.
Mr. Speaker, I would like to re-refer House Bill 253, Health Care Commission, and House Bill 266, Cardiovascular Disease and Diabetes Initiative, to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. And I would also like to re-refer House Bill 313, Licensing of Employer Daycare Facilities, to Committee Number 9, Minerals.
Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Any other re-referrals? Representative Brown, I'm assuming you would like privilege of the floor.
Privilege
please proceed.
Of the floor, Mr. Speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, I just didn't want today to pass without remembering that 50 years ago today was a day that's sometimes referred to as the day the music died, when Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Ritchie Valens were killed in a plane crash in Iowa. And if you can remember that, you're older than the speaker. Thank you.
Actually, if you were alive then, you're older than the speaker. Committee announcements. Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock to hear five bills, very rare and uncommon areas. That's a continuation of a bill that we heard earlier. House Bill 301, Wyoming Industrial Partnership Act 2. House Bill 228, Credit Union Depository of Public Funds. House Bill 288, Certificate of Authority High Voltage Transmission Lines. House Bill 303, Wyoming First Children's Finance Authority 2. And if I may, privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
I'd like to note all of the Ruby Tuesday Maroon Platoon colors today, and thank you for that. Remind you that tomorrow's hump day. If you've got any camel-colored clothes, wear them tomorrow. And then a special thanks to all of you who sent in your checks and credit card numbers for the Coleman Race for the Cure.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet at 5:15 to continue taking testimony on House Joint Resolution 17, Defense of Marriage, and hopefully work that bill. And we will also work House Bill 73, Victims of Crime, reporting a notification tonight. And then tomorrow morning, starting at 7 a.m. in room 302, we will start with House Bill 273, Duty Owed to Employees of Independent Contractors, and House Bill 64, Co-Employee Immunity.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet Wednesday morning, February the 4th at 7:30 a.m. in H-10. And this is an amended announcement because House Bill 286 is the first bill we'll hear. Federal Natural Resource Policy Account, House Bill 21, Gray Wolves, House Bill 32, Gray Wolves, House Bill 143, Gray Wolves, House Bill 148, Gray Wolves, House Bill 245, Wolf Management. And privilege of the floor, Mr. Speaker,
please.
Yes,
proceed.
I do remember Buddy Holly, and I would remind these folks that he was 60 miles from my hometown in Lubbock, Texas.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room 204 to hear House Bill 299, School Facilities Budget Process. And then at 9 a.m., we will have a budget bill review with the Senate. And hopefully soon you will have House Bill 1 on the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow morning in H-11 at 7:30 to finish up on House Bill 244, Uncompensated Trauma Care, and then we'll do 184, Mineral Tax Audit, 283, Taxation and Revenue Digital Products, 307, Subdivisions, Agriculture Land, 275, Wind Turbine Royalty Fee, and HJ5, Energy Dividend. And if I might have the privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
I apologize I didn't get the announcements out for our devotional time in the Herschler building. They're up in my office if you want one. But we will meet at 6:30 in the morning in the Herschler Commons for that devotional time. Thank you.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, your committee number four, House Education, will meet Wednesday, February 4th upon adjournment that evening in room H10, where we will take up House Bills 236, School Finance Instructional Facilitator Program, House Bill 248, School Facilities Remedial Remedy Criteria, House Bill 249, Public Education Accountability, and House Bill 255, School Districts, Kindergarten Programs, all brought to us by the good gentleman from Natrona County.
Chairman Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number five, Agricultural, Public Lands and Water Resources, will meet Thursday, February 5th at 7 a.m. to hear House Joint Resolution 16, Immigration Reform, House Bill 208, Brands, House Joint Resolution 14, National Animal Identification System, Senate File 8, Engrossed Feral Livestock, and Senate File 36, Intentional Feeding of Elk. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Chairman Landon.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow afternoon upon adjournment in 302 to hear House Bill 151, Ultrasound Requirements for Abortion, and House Bill 154, Abortion Reporting Requirements.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet at 5:15 p.m. tonight, Tuesday, February 3rd, in room H-17 to discuss House Bill 45, Severance Tax Distribution, House Bill 85, Motor Vehicle Chain Law, House Bill 179, Phase 2 Study I-80 Tolling, House Bill 191, Motor Carrier Transportation Contracts, and House Joint Resolution 13, Employee Free Choice Act.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your good work on the floor and in committees. You've got some tough bills in committees, and I know sometimes it's hard to not become overly emotional about some of these things. And I just want you all to know that I appreciate the hard work that you're doing, and honor you with this comment today. Thank you for that. And Representative Brown, I was wondering what you will be doing to be honoring the Big Bopper. Will you? Do you have an outfit? Never mind. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House adjourn until February 4th, 2009 at 10 a.m.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye. All those opposed, no. We are adjourned until Wednesday morning, February 4th, 2009 at 10 a.m.